Chapter 5, Saturday Night Live, The Part Where I Leave. Over the 15 years I spent at SNL, I worked on hundreds of sketches, many of them just big, dumb, silly stuff like Belushi as Elizabeth Taylor choking on a chicken bone. But the body of work I'm proudest of is the political satire that the show produced. It's important to emphasize that that work reflects the contributions of many writers and cast members. But more than anyone else, myself included, the credit for the sustained quality of SNL's political satire belongs to Jim Downey, the show's longtime head writer, producer, and occasional performer. Jim had a hand in virtually every SNL debate sketch during the nearly 35 seasons he spent at the show, including the genius strategery lockbox debate he wrote between George W. Bush and Al Gore, played brilliantly by Will Ferrell and Daryl Hammond, respectively. Bush never said strategery until Jim put it in Will's mouth. There's a good argument to be made that Jim's 2000 debate sketch was the most important piece of writing in that election cycle. Americans knew that Bush had trouble with the English language. Bush had made fun of that himself. But Jim caught a certain superciliousness with Daryl's Gore that Americans hadn't quite put their finger on. Jim and Daryl nailed it so specifically that anyone who watched the sketch couldn't help associate the real Gore with the fake Gore's repeated sighs and constant invoking of the Social Security lockbox. With that election decided by some 500 votes in Florida and a 5-4 Supreme Court decision, it's easy to argue that Jim Downey changed the course of history. I would say tragically. I think Gore would have been a great president, may well have prevented 9/11, and would not have sent us to war in Iraq based on manufactured evidence. And he'd have addressed climate change, which to me is the greatest existential threat facing mankind. So thanks, Jim. During the George H.W. Bush administration, Jim and I wrote any number of cold openings, knowing that Dana Carvey's Nagada Bush could get laughs pretty much at will. Nagada, of course, meant I'm not going to do it, as in Nagada wouldn't be prudent. Jim and I would craft a piece that had a progression. This vial of crack was found in Lafayette Park, just across the street from the White House. This hypodermic needle was found on the White House lawn, and this bag of cocaine was found right here in the Oval Office just 2 feet from my desk. It's bad. It's bad. It's getting bad. Dana could get so many laughs along the way with just his hands that the audience would sometimes lose the through line, and between dress rehearsal and air, Jim and I would actually have to tell him not to get so many laughs. Dana, of course, to his enormous credit, understood and delivered every time. Jim is an open-minded political conservative. I like to think I'm an open-minded liberal. We, like Lorne and everybody else on the show, felt it wasn't our job on SNL to have a political bias and advocate for one side or the other. That was fine for a show like Murphy Brown, a sitcom created by one person, Diane English, and starring Candace Bergen as a feminist TV journalist. SNL was a comedy variety show with many writers and performers, each with distinct views and voices. Sure, the preponderance of our cast and staff had your garden variety Hollywood liberal views, but we tried to do well-observed political satire that made the audience laugh and had the virtue of not being stupid. Jim's rule was to reward viewers for knowing stuff about politics without punishing them for not. So SNL wasn't the place to push my own personal political agenda. I saved that for my son's Little League practices. At the show, I was part of a team of dozens of writers and performers, and for our team, funny was the only thing that mattered. I did, however, start taking advantage of more and more opportunities to do political satire outside the show, where I could be a little more pointed about making fun of people who really deserved it. In the summer of 1992, I anchored a series of specials on Comedy Central, covering every night of both the Democratic National Convention in New York City and the Republican National Convention in Houston. We called the show Indecision 92. We broadcast out of a small studio in Lower Manhattan. Our pledge was that viewers of our coverage wouldn't miss anything that happened. To accomplish this, I sat at an anchor desk with a screen behind me, carrying the live feed from the convention floor that the network shared. Writer and humorist Roy Blunt Jr. sat nearby in a Barca lounger, watching four TVs tuned to the coverage on ABC, NBC, CBS, and PBS. That way, if anything important or interesting happened, we could bring it to you within 10 seconds. For instance, if Dan Rather said, if a frog had side pockets, he'd carry a handgun, Roy would let us know right away. Modern political conventions tend to be tightly scripted, which is why the broadcast networks devoted only 2 hours a night to covering them. We did 4 hours a night, giving us plenty of time for commentary and comedy from a slate of special guests designed for political junkies. Norm Ornstein, Christopher Hitchens, Calvin Trillin, Ben Stein, Lawrence O'Donnell Jr., and Roger Ailes. Yes, Roger Ailes, who actually was very funny and who, as far as I know, did not sexually harass anyone during the 2 hours he was with us. Between the two conventions, my favorite letter came from a viewer who wrote, "The guy you had play Norm Ornstein was perfect." During the first night of the Republican National Convention in Houston, Ben Stein and I did commentary live during Pat Buchanan's religious war speech, the one that Molly Ivan said probably sounded better in the original German. Watching the speech, I made the comment that Buchanan's angry tone would hurt the Bush campaign, and of course it did, which traditional pundits wouldn't pick up on for weeks. In their 1992 year in review, Rolling Stone said it was disorienting to watch a comedy broadcast that almost incidentally told more truth and offered more insight than most networks and newspapers, and at the same time was so much more comfortable to watch. Today, of course, the idea of comedy that tells the truth in a way that serious political analysis misses isn't strange. Jon Stewart and Stephen Colbert became not just successful comedians, but respected political figures, because night after night, year after year, they offered more truth and insight than most real TV news. But they didn't invent meaningful political satire. They just brought it to a level of unprecedented popularity and influence. Before The Daily Show and The Colbert Report, there was Politically Incorrect with Bill Maher. And before Politically Incorrect, there was Indecision 92. And before that, there was something Jonathan Swift wrote about the potato famine. After the 8 nights of coverage of the conventions, we added a 9th show on election night, 1992. The evening began with a balloon drop as we called the election for Bill Clinton several hours before the networks did, based on exit poll data we had obtained from sources inside one of the networks, Norm Ornstein. By disregarding the notorious unreliability of exit polling, Comedy Central became the first source to break the news that Bill Clinton had been elected the 42nd president of the United States. And I'm afraid that maybe I was just a little too visibly happy about it. You see, in 1994, I was vying for a job that I had wanted for years at SNL, anchoring Weekend Update. But because I'd been wearing my bleeding liberal heart on my sleeve more and more, it was next to impossible for me to be an unbiased voice on the show's signature segment commenting on the week's news. That year, I headlined the White House Correspondents' Dinner, which Beltway nerds nerdily referred to as the Nerd Prom, because it allows the Washington elite to mingle with the significantly more attractive Hollywood elite. Shortly after my performance, I was in Lorne's office with Steve Martin and Lorne. "Al, I saw that White House Correspondents' Dinner," Steve said, grinning. "You were great. That's what you should do." When Lorne didn't say, "Well, Steve, that's exactly what Al's going to be doing as the new anchor of Weekend Update," I kind of knew where things were headed. Lorne and Don Ohlmeyer, then head of NBC, went with Norm Macdonald, who in retrospect was a much better choice. Losing out on Update was a big part of the reason I decided it was time to move on after 15 seasons at SNL. It was a difficult decision. I loved the show. Lorne had created a safe haven for writers and performers, And there was nothing quite like writing something on a Tuesday night and seeing it kill on Saturday. But as we learn in Ecclesiastes, there is a time for all things, a time to kill, a time to heal, a time to leave the show, a time to stay much too long at the show. After the correspondence dinner, the whip-smart Leslie Schnurr, who had edited the Stuart Smalley book that eventually turned into the Stuart Smalley movie, suggested I try my hand at a political book. The title came to me in a flash. Rush Limbaugh is a Big Fat Idiot and Other Observations. The title, you see, was an ironic comment on the loss of civility in our public discourse. Limbaugh, with an audience of 20 million listeners a week, had been the bombastic cheerleader for the Gingrich Revolution, which culminated in the 1994 midterm elections when Republicans took the majority in the House for the first time in 40 years. The distinctly anti-government Limbaugh-Gingrich agenda swept in a significant number of radical Republicans, and with them a partisan enmity that has just grown even worse over the past two decades. In addition to the nastiness, there seemed to be a new willingness to lie about basic facts. According to Limbaugh, there is no conclusive proof that nicotine is addictive, and there are more American Indians alive today than when Columbus landed in 1492. And if all the polar ice caps melted, sea level would not rise. Rush explained that if an ice cube melts in a glass of water, the water level remains the same. Unfortunately, Greenland is a landmass, not an ice cube. Leaving SNL seemed like a good opportunity to use my comedic chops to influence the national political conversation instead of using my political knowledge to inform the comedy on the show. In Rush Limbaugh's Big Fat Idiot and Other Observations, I not only focused on Limbaugh and Gingrich, but also took on the whole cast of characters from the whack job right, from elected officials to conservative activists to columnists and TV pundits. When I finished the book, I had the publisher send Rush a copy with a note saying, "Al thinks it would help sales if you mentioned the book on the show." Well, one thing Rush Limbaugh isn't, is an idiot. He was, however, very fat. So he kept his mouth shut. Nevertheless, Rush Limbaugh's Big Fat Idiot and Other Observations shot to number one on the New York Times bestseller list and stayed there for 23 weeks. Even better was the reaction I was getting from readers. When I traveled around the country on the book tour, progressives would come up to me and say things like, "Thank you," or "It's about time somebody took these guys on," or "Thank you, it's about time somebody took these guys on." This was new. I'd always thought there was nothing better than hearing people laugh, but hearing people tell me that they were not only entertained, but also energized to go out and take these guys on themselves, well, that was thrilling. It felt good to land on my feet, and it made it a lot easier to laugh along with Norm on Weekend Update. Hey, I'm human.